You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is episode 30. Hey, so maybe you've seen the Netflix film, Don't Look Up. It was released in December 2021, and it's loaded with Hollywood stars. The film follows a group of experts trying to get politicians to act on evidence that they have about a global humanity-ending disaster that's just about to happen. The film got a lot of attention from the science policy community for how it depicts the way experts communicate, or fail to communicate, evidence and new ideas in political communities. Well, Hollywood chooses to portray experts in particular, sometimes peculiar ways. And those choices have profound impacts on how audiences think about subjects as different as dinosaurs, robots, and climate catastrophes. But do those portrayals also change the way we think about the experts themselves and the very process of expertise? Does Hollywood play some kind of under-the-table role in teaching us which experts to trust? That's the theme for today's podcast. We're going to listen into a conversation between three experts here in STS who study science policymaking as a process. They talk about a couple of films in which experts play starring roles. To get things started, they concentrate on Don't Look Up and a 2009 disaster film released by Sony Pictures called 2012. Now, in some ways, these films are very different, but in key ways, they're also remarkably similar. The conversation you'll hear was organized and led by Heis Suing Chong, one of the students in this year's STS newsroom. Heis keeps things moving, and she keeps our panelists on their toes. In fact, she's ready to go right now, so I'll just hand over the microphone to her, and I'll see you on the other side.
Hello, I'm Heis. I studied policy communications and ethics as an IBSC student this year. Could you all give us an introduction of yourselves?
Yes, yeah, so I'm Jack Stilbone, Professor of Science and Technology Policy, and I'm interested in anything to do with the relationship between science, technology and policy, but in particular, stuff to do with new technologies.
I am Sahili. I am a lecturer teaching in science policy with a focus on responsible research and innovation. And my interest is looking at the global level or global governance of emerging technologies.
And I'm Stephen Hughes. I'm a lecturer in the department. And I'm interested in the relationships between science and society and thinking about questions of communication and engagement in those difficult contexts.
Great. So today we'll be talking about two movies that we watched. 2012, a film that was released in 2019, and Don't Look Up, that was released in 2021. Though they have different visuals and very different mise-en-scene, they both talk about kind of the same issue at the end of the day. It's kind of like an apocalyptic event. So I just wanted to use this time to kind of discuss what you think about these reactions. Was it a good reaction? Was it realistic? And how we should govern around these issues and today's public's idea of scientists and science policies. So to start off with, what did you all think about the two movies?
I firstly want to say thank you for making me watch 2012, which was, I mean, it was awful. An awful film. I watched it with my children. I saw Don't Look Up at the time because it was the sort of thing that, you know, suddenly started being talked about by science policy people. We'll talk about why. But yeah, 2012 was quite something.
Yeah, I confess that I did a little bit of skipping through it as well because it's so long. Both movies are actually quite long.
Mm. Yes.
I watched Don't Look Up for the second time this time. I think I enjoyed it a lot more the first time than I did the second time. But it was very interesting to think about, even though there's only a decade roughly between the two movies, how differently, you know, science and policy are kind of represented. And there's similarities there as well. But I found in watching the two of them together really interesting, you know, what went on during those 10 years.
Yeah. So, Harry, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, so kind of somewhere in between both Stephen and Jack, but I do agree with Jack. 2012 was just awful. In many ways, I mean, it has layers of how awful you can get. And I think both movies were interesting in different ways. But both of them, I think we'll talk about this more later, were both kind of in pursuit of a one-shot event, unlike what they're both trying to talk about, which is climate change, which is not a one-event story at all.
So the movie both starts with introducing the scientists. Mm-hmm. In 2012, there's a scientist called Adrian Helmsley, and in Don't Look Up, there's Professor Randall Mindy and the PhD student Kate Dibiaski. What did you think of their images, scientists, compared to the reality?
Well, I think people at universities, we know that scientists, real scientists, aren't that hot. So there's something quite interesting, isn't there, about there were cliched scientists in both films. The sort of socially awkward, poorly dressed, that sort of scientist, they were present, but they weren't the stars. So the stars were the glamorous scientists in all cases.
I think it's probably the most enjoyable part of the movie, where they sort of introduce the event through the lens of the scientist. And there's something about the fact that you don't quite understand the significance of what it is that the scientist is realizing. And there's this really wonderful, juicy tension that's building up, where you can see that they are seeing something and you want to know, what is this? Where Jennifer Lawrence's character is like tracing the path of the comet, and you know, because the movie exists, that something big is about to happen. There's also a really interesting tension, I think, between the sort of, yeah, they're like super glamorous and like movie star hot, but then at the same time they go to great pains to sort of paint them as being kind of very ordinary and laid back and kind of relaxed and cool. Particularly again, Jennifer Lawrence's character, she like smokes weed, and she is like, the audience can see things in a kind of very everyday way. So that's an interesting position for her in terms of how the audience is thinking about who a scientist is.
So Heli, do you have anything to add?
Yes, I thought that was actually very cool, and it goes to a lot of the things that was portrayed in both the movies, especially in 2012 when Adrian Helmsley is introduced and he's going to the depths of the earth. It's kind of, in both movies, really, you get to see how they're collecting the data. Well, you know, after the first scene, he's completely in the White House. You don't see him doing all of this data collection. But then both movies start by showing you that these are scientists who actually gather the data themselves. And that is the basis of the claims that they're making. And then the two movies follow two different trajectories.
Yeah, there's something funny, isn't there, about starting with the science, because it frames the issues in both cases as ones of science. And then the problem becomes, do people or don't people listen to those scientists? So is the protagonist powerful, or are they frustrated in it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, in Don't Look Up, it then becomes all about science communication. How do you communicate this data that you find? And in the case of 2012, it's about how do you keep it hidden? Instead of communicating, they assume that there's going to be mass panic, wherein they will not be able to save humanity. It just becomes, for me, about trust. So in Don't Look Up, they trust the public. In fact, as we go through the movie, the scientists choose to speak to the public themselves. It does not quite work out the way they want it to. But in 2012, the trust issue is not there. They do not communicate to the public until the very last 24 hours. So there's this tension and the dynamics which remains unresolved as to what to do with the public.
2012 is sort of deeply paternalistic, isn't it? It's that sense that decision makers and scientists conspire against the public. Well, actually, there's very little made of the negatives of that relationship. And I was sort of imagining the situation. You know, soon after the scientist discovers his one big fact, which is that the Earth is going to explode, yada yada, spoiler, he then literally speaks truth to power by running into a party and trying to get the attention of the people in power. And the White House Chief of Staff immediately goes, oh, okay, we should do something about this. And I was sort of thinking, oh, I wasn't expecting that to play out at all. I was sort of thinking that there would be various forms of denial, because Don't Look Up is all about denial. But there's something sort of brainless about how the Hollywood ideal of the scientist becomes even more of a cliche in 2012. It's all about, well, how do we stop the public from finding out while the clever boffins and the exceptionally well-meaning president of the United States conspire to come up with a solution that will save the human race, if not the planet.
So how would that actually happen in reality? There was a lot of mention of peer reviews also in Don't Look Up. So why is it so stupid? What would the actual scientific society do with a discovery like that?
The psychology of it, as we've seen with climate change, is that people are very good at finding ways to deny inconvenient truths.
Yes.
And that's what seems so sort of ridiculous about 2010, is that once told the big fact, the world's going to end, people go, okay, let's accept that and work out what to do with it, rather than to find ways to undermine, to pick apart the science, to say, how do we know this? Which is exactly what we've spent the last, not we, but organized denial around climate change.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing that both of the movies sort of miss, because the conceit within Don't Look Up is that it's a very single, verifiable fact that there's some very basic mathematics that can determine whether this object is going to crash into the planet or not. And as Saheeli was saying earlier, climate change is a series of events over multiple scales of space and time. And an interesting factoid, the name of the production company Hyperobject for Don't Look Up references an idea by a philosopher named Timothy Morton, who used this concept of the hyperobject to describe just how hard it is to articulate what climate change is, because it sort of extends beyond our everyday ways of making sense of the world. Geological time, planetary scale, huge shifting climate patterns with so many different inputs and outputs that an individual human or even small groups of humans aren't really built to comprehend a concept like that. So he used the term hyperobject to describe climate change. And that question then to humanity is, we need ways of representing hyper objects if we are to understand and tackle them. But I think going back to that idea of denial, and I think it's a really interesting contrast how in 2012 we get this really simplistic acceptance, which is absolutely not how people would react to something like that. And then with Don't Look Up, we get this kind of exhaustive denial where it kind of falls into absurdity, and that's where a lot of the humor comes from. But I think it gets a little bit mean and goes a little bit too far, where it starts to infantilize people, and it really hits people over the head with the idea that social media equals vacuous, equals superficial. And you have this Ariana Grande character who's just stupid and involved in these absurd, pointless narratives, used as a kind of foil against the significance of this.
And the son of the president, who's sort of the ultimate brainless figure representing societal ignorance. You know, these people that just refuse to understand. So we would talk about it in terms of a deficit model. There's some people that are able to comprehend this inconvenient fact, and then Don't Look Up, other people that just aren't and would rather come to extinction. I think things get quite interesting, though, with Don't Look Up when it comes to the sort of Elon Musk figure, the very powerful tech billionaire.
Peter
What's-His-Face, played by Mark Rylance in some sort of ridiculous dental prosthetic. But he's the guy that is a sort of mix of denial. He sort of has some heterodox science. At one point, again, spoilers, the proposed solution is to destroy the asteroid. But Mark Rylance kiboshes that scheme, comes up with an alternative sort of non-peer-reviewed science, a classic sort of Elon Musk trying to sell his submarine in an emergency, right? That sort of response, because he wants to mine the asteroid for rare earth minerals and then dooms humanity by doing that. So there's quite an interesting heterodox voice of science, who in this case is tech versus the sort of boring, authoritative, peer-reviewed, fact-based science.
In one of the lines, Peter, the CEO of Bash, says is that poverty, social injustice, loss of biodiversity, all these multitudes of problem are just going to become relics of the past, and humanity is going to stride into the glory of a golden age. I thought that was quite hilarious. What did you guys think about his view?
Well, it may be hilarious, but it's actually quite dark in the sense that if you see a lot of the big tech companies, for example, GPT-4, helping with climate change, helping with sustainability issues, it is doing precisely the opposite. So it's not really hilarious in the sense that the reality is much more darker. That's probably the point of the director, is to kind of emphasize the fact that while it is hilarious, this is the problem that the big tech or AI telecoms, that's what they're trying to, you know, greenwashing, if you will, or ethics washing, and by saying these grand challenges could do. It's precisely the language. If you look at a lot of the big tech, that's what they use. AI will help with climate change. This is the final solution, you know, that sort of language. I mean, that is the problem. So I think in that sense, I quite get what it was trying to do. But the problem for me is that climate change is not a one-issue event. It's not an end destination. So governing this is going to impact different people in different parts of the world very differently. And that's where finding consensus is not just hard. It's much more nuanced, complex than, you know, the two movies would have you think about it. But then what can you do in 2 hours?
Yeah, and a lot of us had that exact problem with Don't Look Up. Terms of the representation of the existential threat, that it was not just failing to represent the complexity of climate science, but also it depoliticizes climate change, right? It says by seeing climate change as an extinction event rather than as a slippery slope towards increasing levels of misery, especially for those already most oppressed, it sort of misrepresents the social nature of the issue as well. And some people in SDS have talked about this as, and they critique science for exactly this. Right, they've said science has sort of taken on some of the millenarian flavor of its own fictional representation. Things like tipping points, planetary boundaries, which have become terms of art in climate science because they suggest that there are lines that past which we must not cross. And partly that's a way to wake people up, to get them to pay attention to this issue that they've been systematically ignoring. But by misrepresenting the issue, there's a danger also that when those things fail to come to pass, then science's credibility suffers as well.
I hope you're enjoying our discussions, and we'll come back after a short break.
Are you thinking about UCL for your university? The Department of Science and Technology Studies offers 2 undergraduate degrees leading to a BSc with honors, one in sociology and politics of science, another in history and philosophy of science. Ask questions about wider contexts and deeper meanings. Connect with radical thinking and careers that are future-focused. Find out more online at ucl.ac.uk/STS.
Can I just pick up on the escape vehicle? In both films, there's a sort of escape story, and it's this that the Mark Rylance character is talking about. You know, if only we could get rid of all of this mess and politics, all of this nastiness, this misery on Earth, and start again, right? The ultimate utopian escape fantasy. And in both films, there are escape vehicles, and in both, they are reserved for a privileged few.
The emergency submarines and transport. For 2012, they had 4,000 seats available. And for Don't Look Up, they had 2,000. According to a Netflix fan page on 2012, it meant that 6 billion people were left dead. So
and they've obviously done some sort of calculation and worked out that you need a couple of thousand. Yeah. So that's the sort of right size
That's fair enough. And they actually say in the movie that they had the geneticists determine the perfect gene pool for evacuation. So if we were to be in a situation where the whole human species would extinct, what do you think of this whole perfect gene pool for evacuation and the whole importance of repopulating?
But it's sort of part of the amazing technocracy of the response in 2012, isn't it? The idea that once the scientists have articulated the problem and immediately predicted everything that will happen down to the last hour and minute, they then are involved in coming up with the solution. And the solution, ridiculously, is a sort of uncontested one. So first of all, you put people in the magic arcs, and then you define who counts more than others in terms of restarting the human race. I don't remember at any point that being contested, which given what we know about eugenics and arguments about who has the best genes, you would imagine there to be quite a lot of contest. You would hope there was quite a lot of contestation on exactly that, but apparently good old Danny Glover and his scientists came up with the right answer there. So they sorted that one out.
Yeah, but it just turned out to be rich people.
Yeah, and it turns out that it's rich people. Good. Yes. But yeah, this sort of in 2012, it's this sort of globally endorsed secret plan that all of the scientists go along with, until right at the end when one of the scientists goes, hang on, this doesn't seem right.
Yes.
and becomes the moral heart of the film as well. But it's sort of quite late in the day to start doing that. And then let's invite some poor people onto the ark as well.
Yes, exactly. There was a scene where the president of the United States made a huge speech about how he's not going to get up onto the evacuation boarding.
I love the president in that. Who was this ridiculous moral character, the Danny Glover sort of, I am a good Morgan Freeman type.
Yes, yeah. To stay with the poor people, suffer with them.
In terms of the governance, the very, very end of it is like so weird. There's this like weirdly warped sudden bit where they're like, yeah, Africa was never touched. Right. And it's like, right, did they just put that in because they're like, oh, we need to think about, you know, global perspectives here. So they jam this line in to sort of say, well, you know, OK, we are thinking about the rest of the world. And then they go in their weird colonial arc. We've already set the coordinates now. And you see all this massive big colonial ship full of white people just heading off to Africa at the very, very end.
That's really interesting. In 2012, they all go to China, but then there's no discussion. There's no Chinese precedent in the whole movie at all. Like, what did they have to say about this? Everybody building things, big parks in China.
Quickly, they're in Tibet, aren't they? But they don't engage with the rather difficult politics of being in Tibet.
But the map says China, and that's it. There is no Tibet or China.
Yeah, it's just China.
You don't want to kill your Chinese audience by starting to talk about Tibet as a separate country.
What's interesting, he has this map that just says China, and he knows exactly where to go.
Yeah.
So China is such a small country that you would know exactly where to go. Quite interestingly, they had which wave was going to come from which side at which speed, all mapped out. But nobody actually sits there to figure out, well, can we do something to counter this? You know, you have things like geoengineering, but the movie does not get into that. And I mean, I get it. They're trying to collapse the whole climate change narrative into 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But the choice of narrative really doesn't do justice to what climate change issue is, because number one, it doesn't show the key actors who created the problem, like the fossil fuel extraction industries. This is like the neutrino effect, and something happens at the core of the earth. This is beyond our control. Nobody has contributed to it.
Yeah,
so you don't have in Don't Look Up as well who created the problem. So that issue, Hollywood has bypassed it, because that's the tricky one. You never know. I mean, for example, the private equity which funded both may have had vested interests in fossil fuel, so you cannot say much against it. So, you know, it makes you think that why are the key detractors, the problem creators, are completely absent from both.
Yeah, I mean, films utterly depoliticize the causes of the apocalypse. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that in 2012, there's no consideration of possible responses as well, which is, I mean, the ultimate depoliticizing of climate change is to say nothing can be done about that.
Yeah.
It sort of goes back to the old Frederick Jameson quote, it's easier for us to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the overthrow of capitalism. And climate change, according to some analysts, poses fundamental challenges to how we live, and therefore it's easier for some people to just say, oh, well, let's just all go to hell then.
Yeah, and I think the part of it is to do with almost like the form of cinema and the fact that it needs to be consumed as this leisure object. And I think there's only so much friction and discomfort that they can reasonably, in a popular cinematic movie, integrate into it. And I think that there's some of the trade-offs that Don't Look Up has to make in terms of its sort of like political message. You know, the scientists have to be relatable, identifiable, and it has to look enjoyable to do science. Like, you know, like there's this constant economy of desire throughout the whole thing, so that even the villains need to be kind of like funny, you know, we need to be able to enjoy their villainy by sort of like, you know, laughing at the irony and that type of thing. And it might be just too boring and too mundane to be like, well, no, we do know who is causing this.
Yeah.
It's actually really shit. And that's the problem, I think, kind of going back to that point I was making about the social media, the Ariana Grande popular culture kind of skewering. I think it misses its mark in doing that by sort of making it out that just like people in general are stupid and they don't see this terrible issue that's happening. Yeah, for sure, there are some institutional causes for that, you know, like politics and the media are to blame as well. But I think that it's really in danger of doing a disservice to the actual political reality for most people, that it's not like a simple choice between A or B, like I accept climate change or I deny climate change. It's like the exigencies of everyday life, the cost of living crisis, the difficulty of working two jobs to support a family, the poor access to healthcare, stress, environmental pollution, all of these things that make it really difficult just to get through day-to-day life in sort of modernity are constraints to accepting this other thing, climate change. And if your brain has to make a choice between the stresses and the difficult issues that you're facing today and next week versus this hyper object, multiple years, vague and undefined threat, well, most people are going to be like, well, I need to put my attention into the threat that's straight in front of me. And I think that Don't Look Up does a disservice to that kind of nuance. But again, it's a Hollywood movie. How can they do that within the bounds of a cultural consumption product, basically?
Yeah, I did definitely have that weird, strange feeling while watching Don't Look Up, of this like the disparity between this big concern of like the whole earth, the extinction, and kind of people living their daily life, kind of general election still going, politics are still going, people are still enjoying media, issues around celebrities. And I think it's also because of a lot of conspiracy theories are all also out there with the good exposure of social media. People are always exposed to these scares of end of the world. So how do you think the government should deliver these serious messages, or even scientists should deliver serious messages that can engage the public with these issues a bit better?
Going back to responsible research and innovation, what it says is you do it incrementally. You start creating awareness among the public of this science, of where this is going, what this does. Instead of in both movies, what you see is this one shot, especially in Don't Look Up, this one shot event, this is the comet in the sky, blah, 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 and it's going to kill you as a planet. Doing all of that in one go, I think breaking it into chunks as the science moves on, making publics more aware so that you don't get this buildup of conspiracy theories by dumping one big science in one lot. Yeah,
Steven? Yeah, I was just waiting to beep. because I look at conspiracy theories a lot. And
your platform is ready for you, Steven.
But this thing I've been thinking about for a long time that I haven't really given enough attention, that I really saw in the contrast between these two movies. And there is some visual cultural shift that happened sometime around 2009, 2010, and, you know, now around power, secrecy and sort of revelation. So before, in a lot of culture, there was this kind of X-Files paradigm, unknowable depth to power, to the US government, these secret agencies. Mm-hmm. And almost people were sort of okay with that, so long as it wasn't really impacting them. Then there was a sort of security that this unknowable power of the state would save us if there was an asteroid, if there was a nuclear attack, that because we don't know, it could be infinitely powerful. And there's one image that I think changed the sort of visual culture around that. And it was at the time when Osama bin Laden was killed by the US, and there was this photograph of Obama surrounded by his generals in the center of the control room.
Yeah.
And it was revealed. And we saw this is as real, as deep, as powerful as it gets. And it was this moment of revelation in this image. And I think that it sort of shifted our cultural interpretation of power to one that is all about, right, we know everything now, and we've seen what power is, and there's a kind of mundanity to that. And I think that Don't Look Up really kind of plays on that, the banality of power, the pettiness of power, incompetence of it. And we see it in a lot of other political, cultural narratives that say, well, there's nothing really here, actually. It's kind of like the Wizard of Oz curtain has been kind of pulled apart. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, great, we can see more and that empowers us. But it's also quite frightening because we see the limitations.
Yes.
Right? You know, like the US doesn't have any secret weaponry or technology or means to thwart the bad guys. They really are scrabbling around trying to understand things like everyone else.
God, that's so interesting. And in the face of the one big problem that matters, you know, when the problem used to be that the baddies had the same number of nuclear weapons as the goodies did.
Yeah.
The one big problem that matters now, there is actually no response.
Yeah.
And this, you know, explains some of the desperation behind the solutionist ideas like geoengineering. And in Don't Look Up, there is a response, but the idiots in power shoot themselves in the foot almost immediately by being persuaded against the one thing that would definitely work according to what the sensible scientists say.
I think there's always this dilemma of people have the right to fight for their lives and people have the right to know, and politicians trying to draw the curtain back again. And I think it's also been portrayed greatly in 2012 and Don't Look Up. So how much transparency should we get?
Well, I think there's no right answer to the question of how much should people know, but I think we can look at previous crises and detect a sort of tendency towards paternalism, the sort of bias against informing the public, which 2012 just completely rehearses.
Yeah.
STS would certainly say, actually, there's space for more democracy than experts sometimes think. But both of these films are pretty good, you know, arguments against democracy because they both presuppose an idiot public that doesn't know how to behave, that will find ways to deny and obfuscate and all the rest.
And I think that this is the really, really, really difficult question. You know, earlier you asked, like, you know, how could we engage people? You know, how should we communicate an issue like this? And, the, you know, the answer is nobody knows. Like, absolutely nobody has any clear way that we need to do it. We have a very broad and general sense that we need to be able to build relationships between people, build relationships of trust, develop forms of leadership that are responsible in themselves, that use resources adequately, that somehow build a fairer base so that people can actually rely on the collective to act in the collective's interest. But short of just saying those types of things, I think we are stuck in a bit of cynicism because there are very few avenues for hope where people can say, yes, that is something that I have faith and trust in that could potentially deliver us from this.
Yeah, well, that was so interesting. So I'm just going to wrap up. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Films like these really hit an intersection between science communication, expertise, and political engagement. Whether it's responsible research, disaster warning systems, innovation, medical ethics, or more, that intersection is precisely where we put a lot of our efforts here in STS. If you know someone interested in ideas like these, ask them to check us out. These all fit under the umbrella of Science and Technology Studies, or STS. We're a thriving community here at UCL, and there's always room to add a few more people. Our series music is Rollin' at Five by Kevin MacLeod. It's available online at filmmusic.io. Heiss included some other music in her piece today. Details are in the program notes. Super big thanks to Hai-Seung Chung for creating this episode, and big thanks too to Maddie Ross, who's working behind the scenes to keep the show moving. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you want to find out more about the show, listen to past episodes, or give us some feedback, just visit us online. Here's the address. It's ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast. Well, that's it for today. Thanks for listening. We'll have another episode ready soon. Until then, just remember, there's knowledge to be found just about everywhere, and that together we are STS. Bye now. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.